Dark Wreath Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn semester 2009, this is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 7. Lecture 22, delivered on November 10, 2009. The title of this lecture is Break-Even Analysis, Optimal Capital Structure, and the M&M Proposition.
Today, Break-Even Analysis, Optimal Capital Structure, and the Miller-Modigliani Proposition. Now, it might sound like break-even analysis really doesn't have a lot to do with optimal capital structure, but it does, and in an oblique way. But it would be really hard to explain that to people who hadn't gone through a finance course like this, why break-even analysis is related in a quite material way to the idea of the optimal capital structure of a firm. Now, that last thing I said there, the Modigliani-Miller, or is it the Miller-Modigliani proposition, I'll get into that at the end, but it has to do with optimal capital structure as well. But let me do this with just a plain old-fashioned math problem. It almost has some algebraic aspect to it, but let me bring up two companies. Company A has a variable cost of $1.25 per unit. And company B has a variable cost of $2.25 per unit. Company A carries fixed costs of $50,000. And company B carries fixed costs of $10,000. Both companies sell their product for $2.50 each. Both companies sell their product for $50.50 each, a piece. The fixed cost, company A carries fixed costs of $50,000, and company B carries fixed costs of $10,000. Now that is a low fixed cost. I wrote $2.25 there. Both companies sell their product for $2.50 a piece. Now, I'll take you back to the dark, ugly days of your past, to slope-intercept form of the linear equation, y equals mx plus b. Do you remember that dark, ugly place in your past and point-slope form of the equation and all that kind of stuff? It will come back to haunt us here in just a few moments. But let me bring up something. Abstracting from the company stuff for a moment, just to get us a model to work with. The total costs, TC, are the sum of variable costs and fixed costs of a firm. I caution, and I think I brought this up in the last lecture briefly, maybe I didn't, but the textbook says, well, let's have a look. Hey, how you doing? Good. They're looking at me like I'm weird. Okay. But the book brings up this idea that, okay, look, you can look through the accounting statement. Well, there's a fixed cost, there's a variable cost, there's a fixed cost, there's a variable cost. Really, it's not that easy. It's actually better to do it from more of a statistical analysis kind of view. You can separate variable and fixed costs statistically, but looking at an accounting statement, it's not as easy as you might think. And I'll give you just an example from one of my own business ventures that I ran for years, my consulting company. When I have I get my utility bill, is that a fixed cost or is that a variable cost? Well, you see that on my financial statement, utilities. $280 for the monthly state P&L. Some of that is definitely a variable cost as the number of consulting gigs I have go up. I'm going to use my printer more. I'm going to have lights on more. Hell, some nights the lights were on all night. I'm going to be maybe using the computers more, heating them up and all that, running the fax machine, burning up electricity. But some of it, those lights are going to be on whether I have 0 gigs or 100 gigs. I was going to be running those lights. So there is one thing, one entry in the financial statement, one expense, has both a fixed and a variable cost component. So it's not as easy as just looking at the accounting statements and saying, oh, well, there's fixed, there's variable cost and all that. No, it's probably better to do it from more of a statistical analysis where you separate them statistically over a period of time, see what's fixed and what's variable. Okay, but we have total cost equals variable cost plus fixed cost. Now, the variable cost is going to be varying with output. We assume that it varies in some strict proportional manner. So I can write the total cost as being a little variable cost per unit, VC, times the output level, Q, plus FC. So that VC there, that little VC, that's variable cost per unit. And again, we would assume that that's some percentage, like 0.25, 0.30, something like that. And then we can go to the next thing. Our total revenue is obviously our price times our quantity. Nothing tough there. So I can say, well, then obviously, profit is how much we take in, total revenue, minus how much we pay out, total cost. And we can look at that as an accounting statement, or we can look at it as an economic statement, where in economics we would talk about cost as including opportunity costs, hidden costs, indirect costs, as well as your direct accounting costs, however you want to look at it. But now I can say, well, profit then is going to be total revenue, which is price times quantity, P times Q, minus the quantity, VC times Q plus FC. And it's nothing complicated about that. Profit is total revenue minus total cost. And I decompose total cost into the variable cost, VC times Q, plus fixed cost, FC. Now I'm going to distribute that minus sign through there by the old distributive property. So profit is P times Q minus VC times Q minus FC, distributing the minus sign through the parentheses. Nothing big there. Now I'm going to do a little bit of rearrangement here. I'm going to factor out the Q. I'm going to factor out the Q. And I'm going to say, okay, profit is actually the quantity P minus VC, all times Q minus FC. Profit is price minus unit variable cost times Q minus FC. Now, honestly, I don't know the extent to which this is commonly used anymore, but back in my day, P minus VC, price minus unit variable cost. Unit price minus unit variable cost, we called that unit margin. That's what we called it. We just called it our unit margin. And you'll hear me use that term now, unit margin, price minus variable cost, on a unit basis. So there's your unit margin times quantity minus fixed cost. Okay? Oops, profit equals. I should have put profit equals there. Didn't put my equal sign in. Okay. No big thing. Nothing biggie. No big thing there. Now, I am going to do one more little quick write-up here. Break-even is the place where profit is zero. That's when you've finally gotten to the output level, excuse me, where you are finally about to make actual money in what you do. Something I don't recall that I ever did as a business person, but I've heard that it happens. So, break-even output. I'm going to write that as break-even output. And I'm going to write that as Q sub BE will be the place where the zero profit happens. Zero equals the unit margin times QBE minus FC. That Q is a special Q, and that's why I give it the Q sub BE. It is the output level that will get us to break even, that will get us to zero profit from negative profit. It's the gateway to a good meal at a decent restaurant. It's the gateway to getting your face on the cover of Money Magazine. It is possibly even the gateway to getting your body in Playgirl magazine. Yes, indeed. Okay. I mean, if Levy Johnson can do it, you can too, dude. Okay. Now I'm going to redo a little rearrangement here. FC, I'm just going to bring the fixed cost over to the other side. FC is unit margin times Q sub BE. And so we come up with the break-even output, Q sub BE, is fixed cost over P minus VC. Break-even is fixed cost over unit margin. Okay. Now, all that means is if you look at it, as your fixed costs go up, your break-even output is going to rise. You can see that. As your price goes up, your break-even output's going to fall. As your unit variable cost goes up, your break-even goes back up. So there's some useful stuff in there. And now what I'm going to do here is, just for the giggles of it, we'll get the break-even output of Company A, which had fixed costs of 50 grand, and its price was 250, its variable cost per unit was $1.25. So I can whack that around a little bit, and I can see that my output that will break even on the company is 40,000. 40,000 units is my break even. I have to get to 40,000 units before I start talking about profit with Company A. Now, if I do Company B to get its break even, the fixed costs are 10 grand over a price of 250 less unit variable cost of 225. And little surprising, except that I set it up that way, is that your break even is again at 40,000 units. So we have an interesting situation here. The company that has high fixed costs, low variable costs, and the company that has low fixed cost but high variable cost, they actually come to break even at the same place. Now I'm going to do something that looks entirely academic. I'm going to write the profit equation for each of these companies. Profit. The profit equation for Company A would be its unit margin, 250 minus $1.25 times quantity minus 50 grand. So I can write that a little bit more compactly as profit sub A equals 1.25Q minus 50,000. And the profit of company B as an equation is going to be the price minus its variable costs, in other words, its unit margin times Q, minus 10,000. Or writing it a little more compactly, the profit of B is going to be 0.25 times Q minus 10,000. Are you okay on this? If you're not, just stop me, shoot me with a tranquilizer dart gun. Make sure it has a little chaser of vodka, twist of lemon maybe, please. That's all there is. But you say, no, oh, wait a minute. I remember you said something about slope-intercept form of a linear equation. Well, isn't that slope-intercept form y equals mx plus b? Well, you are absolutely right. That is slope-intercept form. Turns out that the unit margin, that term that I introduced you to there a couple minutes ago, that's a slope of the profit line. That's why I talked about it. That's why it's something that's kind of interesting to mention. It's a slope of the profit line. The y-intercept of the profit line, well, that's the fixed cost of the company. That's the fixed cost of the company. So these actually have meaning geometrically. These different pieces of the a numerical story of the company. So the last thing I'm going to do here with this is I'm going to draw, okay, let me draw these two lines. And I'll do it on one graph. Recognizing as I do that I bitch about rulers being used and I don't have a ruler with me and I can't even draw a line that goes straight. Okay, now here's output. Q is on the horizontal axis. And we'll just do output in ten thousand unit increments. Going up a little ways here, just to make sure that we've 60, 70, 80, 90, 100,000, up to 100,000. Now I'm going to do profit on the vertical axis, profit. Profit is the dependent variable. As you can see, profit's the dependent variable. Q is the independent variable. And so beating this thing through, I'll go 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, and then negative 10, negative 20, negative 30, negative 40. Negative 50, negative 60, negative 70, and negative 10K, and positive 10K. $10,000 increments on this axis. Nothing complicated about this. Now, graphing these, taking you back to the dark days of graphing and doing it the way I used to teach as a math teacher, which I have been for many, many years, just pointing out how I graph, I try to avoid work whenever possible. In this one, for this company A here, its equation is profit equals 1.25Q minus $50,000. So I've got a point right away. The y-intercept is negative 50,000. Okay, are we okay on that? Profit. So I've got one point right now. One, two, three, four. Negative 50,000. But actually, I have another point too. I could do the slope rise over run, 1.25 over one. That's a pain in the ass with this one, considering I'm in 10,000 increments. There's an easier way to do it. I've got another point. I found break even. Break even is where the profit is zero. So I know that for company A, there is a point on the x-axis where profit is exactly zero. I know that 0, 40,000. I'm sorry, 40,000, zero. Yes, 40,000, zero is on the equation of profit line A. Are you okay? Whoa, whoa. I pulled out the break-evens. That would be where profit is zero. So I know that the point 40,000, 0 is on equation A. I know that because the break-even point is where it hits the x-axis, the horizontal axis. Do it that way, and then it won't be a pain in the butt at all to graph these equations. I'm going to do the same thing for equation B, the profit line of equation of company B. Its y-intercept is at negative 10,000, right? You see that? So I've got one point right there. I know that its break-even is at 40,000, so I know at 40,000 on the horizontal axis, I'm at 0 on the vertical axis, so I know that point's on that one too. It just happens to be that way for this problem. It won't always come out that way. So here's the profit line of company A. There it is. As straight as I can draw it without a yardstick here. The profit line of equation A is like that. And the profit line of equation B is like that. And again, you notice that the profit margin, the unit margin, is the slope of the line. A low margin company will have a very shallow profit line. A high margin company will have a steep profit line. And we could even go so far, if we didn't know better, to say, well, obviously in this case, company A is a deliciously superior company to company B, because obviously its profit margin is higher. So once it breaks even, it's making money out the wazoo. Well, and obviously company B is not. But here's the other side of that story. And I want to make sure, and I'm emphasizing this, because generally in business, you'll hear high profit margin, good. Low profit margin, bad. I want to tell you the other side of it and emphasize it. But first, let's make sure that you see high profit margin. Every $10,000 jumps the profit on company A quite a bit. You see that, how it's really rocketing. Once it's broken even, good times ahead. Company B, shallow. Very slowly does it cover its butt as it grows above break-even on its output and sales. Here's the thing, though. Suppose both these companies don't make break-even. Suppose that both of these companies end up making and selling only 20,000 units. Look at how much farther in the hole company A is than company B. If we're talking about total economic cost, we're talking about company B probably covering many of its costs, just not all of its costs. We're talking about company A in much more serious trouble. Yes, there is greater return we could expect on company A, but there is also considerably more downside risk on company A. That's part of the story. You're not in a position to just say company A is a dominant company. It's not. And I can even establish that from the real world and how the global investment community views companies. Let me take a couple of different companies. Suppose we have a company that it's a shopping mall. A giant mega store, makes a huge amount of money all the time, a great profit. Okay. Now, let's take, have any of you ever been to Dollar Tree? Yeah, don't lie to me, you have. Really? None of you have? Oh, yeah, okay, a couple of you. Yeah? Well, I go to Dollar Tree. I'm proud of it. I look like a redneck when I go in there. Hi, everybody, how you doing? But you see, if you look at Dollar Tree, look at Aldi's. I've told you I hate Aldi's. They put your food on the floor. I don't like to buy food off the floor. They make you pay for your cart. Really? Am I going to really steal an Aldi's cart? Yeah. There's a professor walking around with an Aldi's cart. Yeah, uh-huh. No, I'm not. And it pisses me off that they make me pay a quarter like I'm some common criminal who lives in Turnberry. Wait a minute, I do live in Turnberry. No. Okay, here's the thing, though. Here's the thing. Think about a Dollar Tree. You got a company that, after at any time of day, you might see 3, 4, 5 loser customers in there, me among them, walking around, buying some stuff. But one of those stores has to pay its employees. It has to pay to keep the lights on. It has to pay the lease on the building or whatever it does on that. It has to pay for some water if we want to let the employees use the toilet a couple of times on a shift. I mean, the profit margin is pathetic. Maybe $30 in a day. Well, that would, you know, the typical entrepreneurial rich person would laugh his ass off at that. But put 5,000 stores in the North American market. 5,000 stores every day, each one scratching out $30 of profit. You got an operation every day that's pulling $150,000. In a month, $4.5 million. In a year, a staggering close to easily in the $500 million range on low, miserable, pathetic margins per store. That's why stores like Aldi's are perennial love children of the investors. Because think about it. If one of those stores just screws the pooch one day, God finally has enough of it and destroys one of the stores. He nailed a trailer park that was behind it, so he thought, what the hell, let's get rid of this thing, blight too. He still got 4,999 stores. But think about that giant mega store. All of its money that it makes is in one store. And the Lord has a brain fart. Oh, damn. Knocked out that great store. Where am I going to shop? You see, everything's gone. Everything is gone. One store. That's what I was talking about. Remember when I was doing that degree of operating leverage, degree of financial leverage, degree of combined leverage stuff? Remember when I was doing that stuff and I was pointing out how fixed costs create operating leverage? That means risk. That's the point that I'm talking about here, is that just simply looking at the profit line and kind of making fun of that shallow line, that doesn't tell the whole story, because you're talking about more risk with all that fixed cost on one ginormous operation. Instead of scattering your dice across the market landscape three-dimensionally, throwing all your dice in one store, yeah, look at that profit line. It's just taking off like a rocket. But at the same time, it's a lot more dangerous. It's more risk. So you're making a trade-off here. There is no free lunch. Yes, you get higher profit margin on that company A, but you get that at greater risk, which we can see as operating leverage, which we can just simply analyze from a market perspective. This, as I used to from my days as a pilot, if I've got an airplane that takes off on a shallow slope versus an airplane that goes like that, the engine failing on this one is going to make for a much smoother landing than the airplane failing on this one that's made it higher in the air. But there is one comfort about when the engines quit on a plane. There's one thing you know for sure. You will make it to the crash site. Okay. Think about that. Where the hell was I? Oh, I know where I was. I'm going to switch gears here now. What does all this have to do with capital structure? Well, it has to do with risk. And capital structure has to do with risk. What is the best combination of debt and equity, and various kinds of debt and various kinds of equity, that would affirm should take on, especially with equity, common versus preferred, and all that kind of stuff. But some years back, and I, these two academics, Modigliani and Miller, they did a paper in which they said, all right, here are the reasonable assumptions that we can make about debt and the reasonable assumptions we can make about equity. I have talked about these with you. Everything, you could actually read that academic paper and it would not really kill you. You might want to walk around some of the math like I do sometimes, but it was entirely logical. Look, debt is cheaper than equity. It really is. First, debt is the interest expense from debt is tax deductible. So you get a gain to leverage. Remember how we calculate KAT sub D equals 1 minus T times K sub D? You get debt cheaper than equity. You can't deduct your dividends. They're not tax deductible. They are after you've paid your taxes. They're like the most expensive thing you can do. And equity itself is expensive. Now here, it's not just about the tax deduction. The truth of the matter is, the bondholders rule the game. When there is money made, the bondholders get their interest first. If there's any left over, it is up to the company to decide whether the stockholders get any dividends. The bondholders have the prior claim on cash flow. The debt holders, the lenders, have the first claim. And if the company goes tap city, the equity holders, the common stockholders, they're gone. They can pound salt. They've lost their investment. The debt holders can eat the company. They can cannibalize it. They can even explain to the court whether a reorg that the management is proposing is okay or not. They run the show. When the company dies, they get the carcass. The equity shareholder, the equity stake, gone. There's just nothing there. It's out of the picture, unless there's some weird arrangement. So that's why debt is cheaper. It's less risky than equity. So Modigliani and Miller pointed this out. Debt is cheaper than equity. And so they said, well, here's what the weighted average cost of capital should look like under our very reasonable assumptions. Under those same things that I've told you in this class, is that if I had the cost of equity up here and the cost of debt down here, and this was on the horizontal axis, I have the percentage of debt in the capital structure, where we go from 0% up to 100% debt. At 0% debt, you'll pay the cost of equity. The weighted average cost of capital would be the cost of equity if there's no debt. Right, you'd have 0% times KAT sub D plus 100% times K sub S. And as you go towards the point where you finally have all debt in your portfolio, you would have the weighted average cost of capital be K after tax sub D. That's what the weighted average cost of capital should look like. Logically, you should, if you have 100% equity, 0% debt, you would pay the cost of equity, K sub S. If you have 100% debt and 0% equity, you should pay the after-tax cost of debt. So you should have a line going straight down. Rationally, then, every corporation should be 100% debt. Because clearly, your cost of weighted average cost of capital would be lower. That's what the Modigliani-Miller proposition was. Every company should be 100% debt. There should be no such thing as stockholders in any corporation that is rational. I might be pushing a little further. But you see, we know very well that's not true. All this semester, you know, I've talked about, well, 25% debt, 75% equity. Maybe 45% equity, 65%, 55% debt, that whole thing. You know very well it's not true. You can look at any kind of financial statements. You can see debt and equity on the balance sheet. You don't have the Modigliani-Miller proposition. Now, does that mean that Modigliani and Miller were idiots? Surely not. They knew damn well what they were up to. And that's something we do sometimes. It's an important exercise. We say, let's take our totally reasonable assumptions and let us see where they lead us. Wait a minute. They lead us to something that isn't happening. So what's wrong here? What's going on? Obviously, our totally reasonable assumptions didn't work. Now, I'll bring this up like this. Okay. We all know that there's no such thing as ghosts. We really do. There is it. I mean, we like to joke about it. We watch the fun shows, and we go to the movies where there are these terrible ghosts and stories, and ooh, that was wild, and all that. But we know there aren't any ghosts. So when we are offered the chance to stay in a haunted house for a whole night for $100,000, we know very well that we're going to get $100,000 without getting scared, because there really isn't anything such thing as ghosts. Okay, so at the beginning of the evening, they put you into the house. You walk in the door and you look around, hello, and the door slams behind you. Boom! And immediately you are confronted by a 9-foot-tall ghost that's drooling ectoplasm all over, and it's getting on you, and you don't have any Purell to clean yourself, because what kind of bacteria do ghosts have? I mean, it's got, you know, it could be something really nasty. And it's saying, get out! Well, you know very well there are no ghosts, but there it is right in front of you. Yeah. You know. So here's the thing. Empirically, there's a damn ghost there. But you know very well, logically, in your mind, there ain't no ghost, and I ain't afraid of no ghost. But there he is. And you're up to your ankles in ectoplasm, and he's already starting to swirl you around the room, and your head's going around and around like this, saying, eat my dog. Okay, so you've got a disjunction between reality and theory. I'm not even sure how that fits in here, but it works. So, and that's what we sometimes do in economics and in finance, is we say, let's take our logical assumptions, and let's say, what's wrong? Why are we getting derailed? That's a huge thing in logic, is to let rational assumptions take us to a place where we know it's not what's going on. Well, the Modigliani-Miller proposition brought about a firestorm of discussion. And you saw that in this course. Remember what I showed you? There's a point where you are borrowing money and you are creating financial leverage. And financial leverage is risk. And no one is going to be stupid enough to lend you money if it is very risky. When your time's interest earned, you had $100,000 EBIT. And your interest was $10,000, there's your time's interest earned of 10. Well, I'm a lender, that's great. But then you come back to me hat in hand later, and you've gotten yourself so far in debt that you now have $90,000 in interest on $100,000 in EBIT. I realize that just a little bump in sales is going to put you into default. And then I've got to go to court and do all the bankruptcy stuff and all that. I'm not going to be as comfortable, and I'm going to want a greater reward for the risk I'm taking with you. So that means that the Modigliani-Miller proposition is incorrect in assuming that the cost of debt will stay the same. That's why I did that exercise with you with marginal cost of capital, because the weighted average cost of capital is changing, because ultimately the marginal cost of capital, the weighted average cost of capital, is going to look more like this. Yes, at 100% equity, you'll pay the cost of equity. But for a while, as you take on more and more debt, your weighted average cost of capital will fall. Why? Because your marginal cost of capital is underneath. But at some point, what's going to happen is that your marginal cost of capital is going to go above your weighted average cost of capital. And once the last gets higher than the average, it starts to pull the average up. And that's why the weighted average cost of capital curve is a horseshoe, not a straight downward sloping line. And so this is one of those places where, and I'm going to bring up one more just to kind of close this idea off here. But one thing I do want to point out to you is, yeah, here's your sweet spot. There really is a bottoming out point, a percent of debt, and therefore a percent of equity, that is optimal. But I should point this out to you, and I'm being a little bit speculative about, I'll be a little speculative about the circumstances. But you can have companies with very different looking WACs. You can have a company that has a weighted average cost of capital that bottoms out at a very low percentage debt. And then you could also have a company where the weighted average cost of capital drops very slowly, and only at a very high percentage of debt in the capital structure could it be at its optimal bottoming point. It's all dependent. Now, here's one possible reason for that. Remember that this is the result of financial leverage. Remember how I told you that your degree of combined leverage was the result of your degree of operating leverage times your degree of financial leverage, that DCL equals DOL times DFL kind of thing. Okay, think about it like this. Suppose that companies really are not thrilled about going beyond a certain combined degree of leverage. Most companies, I mean, they would sweat if their degree of combined leverage was, let's say, 2.5, something higher than 2.5. Now, I'm speculating on that. But there would certainly be a point where any reasonable financial manager, his back leg would start going up and down with a degree of combined leverage that was higher than a certain amount. So the degree of combined leverage is the product of the degree of operating leverage times the degree of financial leverage. I showed you that last time. Don't sweat. I'm not going to do any hard math here, but I'm going to appeal to something for you to think about here. Suppose most companies really would prefer to have the degree of combined leverage at a specific or in some specific range. Okay, now, you have some industries that are just by their nature very fixed cost heavy. Manufacturing, utilities. They just got a big pile of fixed costs. So if their DOL is high and they wanted to hold the DCL at a specific, in some range, that would indicate that they probably want their DFL to be low. You follow me on that? But if you've got an industry that is mostly service-related, then they don't have a lot of fixed costs, so their degree of operating leverage is low, so they can afford to have DFL higher. So, in a sense, you could see a company that bottomed out optimal capital structure at a very low level of debt, well, that would mean that they don't want lots of financial leverage because maybe they've got a lot of operating leverage, and they don't need the aggravation of more of the other. So, but if you saw a company that tended to have a high degree of debt, that would mean that they've got a high degree of financial leverage, which means that they probably, maybe I should say, they didn't have a whole lot of operating leverage, so they could have more latitude to be more debt laden, have more financial leverage. So if you see these different weighted average cost of capital curves, some skewed downward toward not a lot of debt in the portfolio capital structure, and other companies skewed more towards a lot of debt in their portfolios, or in their capital structures, that might tell me, this company that doesn't have a whole lot of financial leverage, that might be because they've got a lot of operating leverage. And if they had financial leverage too, that'd make their combined leverage really nasty. So they probably are going to be lean on the financial leverage because they're heavy on the operating leverage. But a company that has a high percentage of debt in its capital structure, that's a company that might not have a whole lot of operating leverage, so it has more room to make its financial leverage go up. And so its DCL, its degree of combined leverage, wouldn't get out of hand because DOL is low. So the DFL can be higher. That's one explanation for why we can see not just that Modigliani and Miller led us to understand more about marginal cost of capital and how it causes the weighted average cost of capital to swing upward eventually, but also we can begin to think about the reasons for different companies to have different degrees of financial leverage. Why it is that we do, and we really do see this. We see, and this is one of the things that was early in the Modigliani-Miller argument, and we talked about this in grad seminars in finance, I remember, when we do the financial statistical analysis, we see industries where they think their optimal capital structure is like 10% debt, 90% equity, like this. And then we'll look over here, and here's an industry where the companies are convinced that 80% debt, 20% equity is great. And that says to us, okay, that's interesting. Why is that? Okay, now we can begin to think in terms of these. These aren't really all that complicated. It's not really rocket science. But, I see. The combined leverage is a product of operating and financial leverage. And so as they play with, they might be forced to have one in some configuration, which means that the other one, the degree of financial leverage, is actually sort of dependent upon the operating leverage that the company has to face. That's what I had to say about this topic. On Tuesday, we are going to review, or Tuesday, on Thursday, we're going to review for exam two. So come early and often. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.